by managing to impose themselves on the map of the Middle East in spite of the best efforts of Israel, the United States, and many Arab governments. The Palestinians succeeded in reacquiring something long denied to them, what Edward Said called the permission to narrate. This meant the right to tell their story themselves, taking back control of it not only from Israel's omnipresent narrative in the West, in which the Palestinians scarcely figured except as villains, as in Exodus, for example, but also from the Arab governments. For many years, the Arab states had taken charge of the Palestinian side of the story as their own, relating it feebly as a conflict between Israel and themselves over borders and refugees. One aspect of the rapid ascent in the fortunes of their national movement that has been overlooked is the effectiveness of the Palestinians' communication strategy in the Arab countries, in the developing world, and, to a lesser extent, in Europe and the West. At the UN, where third world countries by the 1960s had a much bigger presence, this translated into a more favorable environment for the Palestine cause. In consequence, the historic gap between the Zionist success in shaping world public opinion and Palestinian ineptness in this sphere began to narrow, partly due to an increase in the number of Palestinians steeped in Western culture or with experience in other parts of the globe. In the Arab world, the movement received an enormous boost in March 1968, 9 months after the war, in Karama, a small Jordanian town, whose name by fortuitous coincidence means dignity. In Israel's biggest military operation since the war, about 15,000 troops with armor, artillery, and air support crossed the Jordan River to eliminate a concentration of Palestinian fighters based in and around Karama. The attackers unexpectedly met fierce resistance from the Jordanian army and the PLO, which inflicted between 100 to 200 casualties on the seemingly invincible Israeli army, and forced it to abandon a number of damaged tanks, armored personnel carriers, and other equipment. In the wake of the disastrous war barely a year earlier, this relatively small engagement, in which the Israelis seemed to leave the battlefield in disarray, electrified the Arab world and revolutionized the image of the Palestinians. Although it was Jordanian artillery and armor, positioned in the hills overlooking the Jordan River Valley, which undoubtedly inflicted the most damage on Israel's forces, the Palestinians fighting inside Karama reaped most of the glory from this episode. The Battle of Karama proved to be a godsend to the propaganda of the Palestinian resistance movement, which effectively publicized the clash as a stand for Arab dignity, trampled underfoot as it had been by the failures of the Arab regimes. As a result, the Palestinian resistance was lionized throughout the Arab world. The irony of this self-presentation was that at its height, the PLO never posed any kind of military challenge to Israeli forces, which defeated all the Arab armies in the field in every one of their conventional wars. Even when PLO forces fought well defensively, as at Karama, they were rarely capable of going head-to-head for very long with one of the most experienced, well-trained, and best-equipped militaries in the world. Moreover, from the beginning of the Palestinian armed struggle in the 1960s until the PLO later renounced this approach, they never were able to develop a successful guerrilla war strategy that might have countered the superiority of Israel's conventional forces or the limitations of being based in Arab countries vulnerable to Israeli military pressure. In fact, the PLO's greatest success in its heyday during the late 1960s and 1970s came in the realm of diplomacy, despite the United States' refusal to engage with the Palestinians. This was visible not only in the Arab world and the Eastern Bloc, which extended limited support to the PLO from the late 1960s onward, but also in much of the Third World, many countries of Western Europe, and even at the UN, Resolution 242 notwithstanding. In the General Assembly, the PLO could now muster majorities that were immune to the veto that the U.S. wielded in the Security Council. There and in other arenas, the PLO achieved a high level of diplomatic recognition, even succeeding to some small degree in isolating Israel. The PLO was recognized by the Arab League in 1974 as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. while simultaneously opening PLO missions in more than 100 countries. The invitation to Yasser Arafat to speak before the UN General Assembly that same year was the greatest diplomatic success in Palestinian history, after so many decades of non-recognition by the League of Nations, the UN, and the great powers. There were different reasons for these limited triumphs. This was an era when successful national liberation movements in Algeria, southern Africa, and Southeast Asia garnered support, including among young people in the West. The PLO's anti-colonial and Third World Revolutionary appeal also resonated with China, the Soviet Union and its satellites, with Third World countries, and among those countries' representatives at the UN. In most of the newly independent countries of Asia and Africa, the Palestinians were seen as another people struggling against a colonial settler project backed by the Western powers. They therefore deserved the sympathy of those who themselves had just thrown off the colonial yoke. At the height of the Vietnam War, these themes had great appeal to disaffected youth in Europe and the United States. Finally, the PLO succeeded to some extent in galvanizing the Palestinian and Arab diaspora in the Americas, who became advocates for the national cause. Yet all of these efforts had severe limitations. Among them were the PLO's failure to devote sufficient energy, talent, and resources to diplomacy and information, despite the gains made in these areas. Nor did the PLO work hard enough at understanding their target audiences, the most crucial of them being the United States and Israel. There, the PLO ultimately failed to overcome a more effective competing narrative generated by Israel and its supporters that equated Palestinian with terrorist. The PLO's incapacity to understand the importance of these two vital arenas started with its top leadership. Respected Palestinian-American academics in the United States, notably Edward Said, Ibrahim Abul-Ghod, Walid Khaldi, Hisham Sharabi, Fuad Mughrabi, and Sameh Farsoon, repeatedly tried to impress on Palestinian leaders that they needed to take American public opinion into account and devote to it sufficient resources and energy, but to no avail. At a 1984 meeting in Amman of the Palestine National Council, PNC, the PLO's governing body, a U.S.-based group in which I participated strove to make this point to Yasser Arafat. He agreed to meet us and listened courteously until, after only a couple of minutes, an aide came in and whispered in his ear. We were hurriedly ushered out while Arafat received one Abu al-Abbas, the leader of the Palestine Liberation Front, a tiny, insignificant faction that caused great damage to the Palestinian cause, but was on Iraq's payroll. Our audience was over, and the opportunity for us Palestinian Americans to make the case for the importance of appealing to U.S. public opinion evaporated. In the PLO leadership's misplaced priorities, the inter-Arab balancing act at which Arafat excelled was more pressing than was furthering the Palestine cause with the public of the preeminent global superpower. Notwithstanding this failure, the Palestinian cause did make some progress in the United States after 1967. This was largely thanks to the efforts of the same group of Palestinian-American academics, who were effective in putting the Palestinian narrative before college campuses, the alternative media, and other sectors of public opinion. Edward Said, in particular, had an outsized impact, articulately making a case for the Palestinians in ways that his audiences had never heard before. While he and his Palestinian-American colleagues were unable to achieve a breakthrough with the mainstream media, which, by and large, continued to repeat the Israeli line, they laid the groundwork for an increased understanding of the Palestinian perspective in future years. As the PLO appeared to go from one diplomatic and propaganda victory to another after 1967, these successes did not go uncontested, each one provoking ferocious opposition from its many foes. Israel's raid on Karama was one of its first efforts to counter the PLO's growing status. A devastating raid on the Beirut airport in 1968 was another. In 1970, the PFLP's aircraft hijackings and Palestinian excesses in Jordan precipitated a disastrous confrontation with the Hashemite regime that the resistance movement was in no position to win. Facing superior force and having lost some popular sympathy, the movement was driven from Amman that year in what became known as Black September, and then completely expelled from Jordan in the spring of 1971. One of the casualties of the Jordan debacle was the aura of successful dynamism that some components of the movement, notably the PFLP, had maintained until that point. The resistance movement's pattern of recklessly provoking its enemies, alienating its hosts, and ultimately being expelled was to be repeated in Beirut 11 years later. Meanwhile, Israel carried out further punishing attacks on Syria and Lebanon, countries from which the Palestinians continued to launch military operations. These included a major ground incursion into South Lebanon in 1972, an aerial bombardment in 1974 of the Nabatiya Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon, which was completely destroyed and never rebuilt, and an invasion that resulted in the long-term occupation of parts of South Lebanon in 1978. All these moves against the PLO benefited from strong U.S. support. Both the Israeli and Jordanian militaries received American arms, and both countries were able to count on full U.S. diplomatic backing. The United States reacted to the increased visibility of the PLO and to what seemed to be a unified Arab bloc in another way as well. Given the USSR's support for the PLO and the Arab bloc, President Nixon and his National Security Advisor and later Secretary of State Henry Kissinger expended great efforts to weaken the Soviet Union's links to what they saw as its Arab clients in the Middle East. The centerpiece of this Cold War strategy was the American attempt to prize Egypt away from the USSR, align it with the US, and induce it to agree to a separate peace settlement with Israel. When this American-led initiative finally succeeded in the late 1970s, under the Carter administration, it had the effect of splitting the nominally unified Arab front and leaving the Palestinians and other Arab actors to face Israel in a much weaker position. In all of this, the United States stuck to the lines laid down in SC 242, which excluded the Palestinians from any share in the negotiations for a settlement. U.S. policymakers were guided by their hostility to the PLO because of its militancy and its alignment with the USSR, but also by Israel's intense opposition to discussion of any aspect of the Palestine question. Thereafter, the PLO was trapped in a dilemma. How could it achieve Palestinian national aspirations through participation in a Middle East peace settlement when the internationally recognized terms for such a settlement, SC 242, negated these aspirations? It was a dilemma remarkably similar to that posed by the Balfour Declaration and the Palestine Mandate. In order to be recognized, the Palestinians were required to accept an international formula designed to negate their existence. The small militant groups that relaunched the Palestinian national movement in the 1950s and early 1960s put forward simple objectives for their struggle. For them, Palestine had long been an Arab land with an Arab majority. Its people had been unjustly dispossessed of their homes, their property, their homeland, and their right of self-determination. These groups' main purpose was to return the Palestinian people to their homeland, restore their rights, and oust those whom they saw as usurpers. The term return was central, as it has been for Palestinians ever since. Most felt no sense that there were now two peoples in Palestine, each with national rights. To them, Israelis were no more than settlers, foreign immigrants to their country. This position exactly mirrored that of most Israelis, for whom there was only one people with national rights in Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. And that was the Jewish people, while the Arabs were no more than transient interlopers. In the Palestinian reading of the day, Israel was a colonial settler project that the West had helped create and supported, which was largely true, and the Israeli Jews were part of a religious group only, not a people or a nation, which the successful creation of a powerful nation-state with a strong national identity had already shown to be false. At this point, the Palestinians had not come to terms with the reality of a new national entity in Palestine, in part because this had happened at their expense and at a ruinous cost to them. The culmination of this thinking about the objectives of the Palestinian struggle was articulated in the National Charter, Al-Mithaq Al-Watani, adopted by the PLO in 1964. The charter stated that Palestine was an Arab country where national rights belonged only to those residing there before 1917 and their descendants. This group included Jews then resident in Palestine, but not those who had immigrated after the Balfour Declaration, who would therefore be obliged to leave. From this perspective, liberation involved the reversal of everything that had taken place in Palestine since the Balfour Declaration, the British Mandate, the partition of the country, and the Nakba. It meant turning back the clock and refashioning Palestine into an Arab country once more. Although the ideas the Charter embodied were reflective of much, perhaps most, Palestinian sentiment at the time, it was adopted by a body created by the Arab League, not one that was elected by or represented the Palestinians. These objectives would change rapidly with shifting circumstances and the transformations of Palestinian politics after 1964. With the takeover of the PLO by Fatah and the other resistance groups in 1968, the national movement formulated a new objective, advocating the idea of Palestine as a single democratic state for all its citizens, both Jews and Arabs. Some iterations referred to a secular democratic state. This was meant to supersede the aims laid down in the National Charter, recognizing that Israeli Jews had acquired the right to live in Palestine and could not be made to leave. The change was also meant to refashion the PLO's image and appeal to Israelis, who were treated by the 1964 National Charter as if they did not exist. The statement that Jews and Arabs living in Palestine were entitled to be equal citizens of the country represented a major evolution of the movement's thinking. However, the single democratic state proposal did not recognize the Israelis as a people with national rights, nor did it accept the legitimacy of the State of Israel or of Zionism. Over time, this new objective came to be broadly accepted among Palestinians and was embodied in successive authoritative pronouncements of PLO policy via resolutions of the PNC. In the end, it superseded the Charter and rendered it obsolete. Yet these fundamental changes were resolutely ignored by the PLO's opponents, who continued to harp on the Charter's original provisions for decades to come. The change also achieved little traction with most Israelis and failed to convince many in the West. Again, the inability of the PLO leadership to understand how important these audiences were, and its unwillingness to devote sufficient resources to explaining the significance of this evolution in order to win them over, doomed any effort to convince others of the validity of these aims. More important, achieving an objective of this magnitude would require the dissolution of Israel with a new state of Palestine taking its place. This would mean overturning what, since 1947, had become an international consensus around the existence of Israel as a Jewish state, as specified by the wording of GA 181. Only a revolutionary shift in the balance of forces both within Israel and globally could accomplish such an end, something that the Palestinians could hardly achieve or even contemplate on their own. And they could not count on their brothers in the Arab regimes. Radical Arab states such as Syria, Iraq, and Libya continued to talk a big game where the Palestine cause was concerned, but their rhetoric was empty. What these states actually did was to sabotage the PLO by sponsoring nihilistic terrorist groups, such as the Abu Nidal organization, which assassinated numerous PLO leaders and killed Israelis and Jews indiscriminately. As for the other key Arab states, Egypt and Jordan, with the support of Saudi Arabia, had by 1970 accepted SC 242, and Syria followed in 1973. This major development, unacknowledged by Israel, amounted to those states' de facto recognition of Israel, at least within the 1949 armistice lines. The dissonance between this crucial shift by several major Arab states and the PLO's position was to have grave consequence for the Palestinians. Changes in regional circumstances led many PLO leaders to consider a further modification of their objectives. A number of factors exerted an influence. The PLO's inability to sustain an effective guerrilla campaign against Israel after the loss of its bases in Jordan, the Arab states' growing acceptance of the conflict with Israel not as existential, but as a state-to-state confrontation over frontiers, and Arab and international pressure on the PLO to conform to more limited objectives. At the Arab League's summit in Khartoum in 1967, the League had declared that there would be no peace, no recognition, and no negotiations with Israel, the three no's, that were much repeated in Israeli propaganda. In reality, Egypt and Jordan welcomed mediation with Israel through UN Special Envoy Gunnar Jarring and later via U.S. Secretary of State William Rogers. The Khartoum summit notwithstanding, the most powerful Arab country bordering Israel had, by accepting SC-242, conceded in principle that its neighbor had a right to secure and recognized boundaries. It remained only for the Arab states and Israel to negotiate those boundaries and the other terms of a settlement. The Jordanian crackdown on the Palestinians in September 1970, although provoked by the PFLP aircraft hijackings, was meant, among other things, to punish the Palestinians for not accepting the new limitations of the key Arab states' aims. Starting in the early 1970s, members of the PLO responded to these pressures, in particular to the urging of the Soviet Union, by floating the idea of a Palestinian state alongside Israel, in effect a two-state solution. This approach was notably promoted by the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which had split off from the PFLP in 1969, together with Syrian-backed groups discreetly encouraged by the leadership of Fatah. Although there had been early resistance to the two-state solution by the PFLP and some Fatah cadres, in time it became clear that Arafat, among other leaders, supported it. This marked the beginning of a long, slow process of shifting away from the maximalist objective of the democratic state, with its revolutionary implications, to an ostensibly more pragmatic aim of a Palestinian state alongside Israel, to be achieved via negotiations on the basis of SC-242. The path toward these radical modifications was not an easy one for the PLO. Only after some of the most severe blows inflicted on the Palestinian national movement since the Nakba did the PLO come to accept a two-state approach based on SC-242. These blows came in quick succession during the Lebanese Civil War, which began formally in April 1975. However, for the Palestinians, the war began 2 years earlier, on April 10, 1973, with the assassination of three PLO leaders in their homes in West Beirut by Israeli commandos led by Ehud Barak, later Israel's prime minister. The crowds of Palestinians and Lebanese attending the funerals of the poet and PLO spokesman Kamal Nasser and Fatah leaders Kamal Adwan and Abu Yusuf Najjar were immense. As I walked with the masses of mourners, I was not surprised to see that they were even larger than those for Ghassan Kanafani. These four men were among the scores of Palestinian leaders and cadres who fell victim to the assassination squads of the Mossad. It is true that nominally Palestinian groups murdered other Palestinian figures, including three members of the Fatah Central Committee and the PLO ambassadors in London and to the Socialist International. These groups served as agents of the three dictatorial Arab regimes, those of Hafez al-Assad in Syria, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and Muammar al-Qaddafi in Libya, that were loud in their proclamation of support for the Palestinian cause, but harsh in their treatment of the PLO. These regimes were patrons at different times of the gunmen of the Abu Nidal organization, which did most of this killing, and other small splinter groups. While the impact of these assassinations by Israel and the hostile Arab powers is a mark of the extraordinarily difficult path trodden by the Palestinian national movement, there is an important distinction between them. The Arab states that used such means wanted to bend the PLO to their will, even by using brute force, as when the Assad regime sent troops to confront the PLO in Lebanon in 1976. However, they operated on the basis of cold, calculating raison d'état. They did not want to destroy the PLO or to extinguish the Palestinian cause. Israel's case was quite different, as this was always its objective. Its long-standing policy of liquidating Palestinian leaders, inherited from the Zionist movement during the late Mandate period, aimed at eliminating the Palestinian reality, demographically, ideationally, and politically. Assassinations were thus a central element in Israel's ambition to transform the entire country, from the river to the sea, from an Arab to a Jewish one. To use Baruch Kimmerling's term once again, this was an example of politicide in its most literal form. As evidence of the extent of the campaign of liquidations, we have two new accounts of it, one of them based on classified Israeli intelligence and military material. Among much else that is new, it contains sensational revelations about repeated attempts to assassinate Yasser Arafat. The pretext that such killings were a blow against terrorism simply do not wash when the target is the leader of a national movement, unless the aim is to destroy that movement. Leaders of other anti-colonial movements were invariably vilified by their colonial masters in similar terms: terrorists, bandits, and murderers, whether they were Irish, Indian, Kenyan, or Algerian. Similarly, Israel's demonization of the PLO as terrorist served as justification for its eradication. The private statements of Israeli Defense Minister Ariel Sharon in 1982 about Palestinian terrorists in Beirut could not be clearer on this point. The justification of assassinations as necessary protection against terrorists who would kill if not killed first also rings hollow when many of those killed, Ghassan Kanafani and Kamal Nasser, for example, or PLO representatives abroad such as Mahmoud Hamshari and Wael Zueitar, were intellectuals and advocates for the Palestine cause rather than military personnel. Their artistic ventures were supplementary and linked to their political activities. Kanafani was a gifted novelist and painter, Nasser a poet, Zueitar a writer and budding translator. These were not terrorists, but the most prominent voices of a national movement, voices Israel was determined to stifle. In Lebanon, the assassinations of Nasser, Adwan, and Najjar in April 1973 were followed 1 month later by an armed confrontation with the Lebanese army, during which the Air Force strafed the Palestinian Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in the southern suburbs of Beirut. Throughout the remainder of the Lebanese Civil War, which dragged on until 1990, Palestinian refugee camps and population centers were a frequent target, besieged, devastated, the scenes of massacres and forced expulsions. Tal al-Za'tar, Karantina, Debay, Jisr al-Basha, Ain al-Hilwa, Sabra, and Shatila. Palestinians in all these places suffered such atrocities. The war also brought horrific massacres of Lebanese Christians by factions of the PLO and its Lebanese allies, notably at Damour in January 1976, where hundreds of Christians were killed, and the town was sacked and looted. Tal al-Za'tar was the largest, poorest, and most isolated of the Palestinian refugee camps in the Beirut area, with a population of about 20,000 Palestinians and perhaps 10,000 impoverished Lebanese, mainly Shiites from the south. It was located in the East Beirut suburb of Dikwana, which was inhabited largely by Lebanese Maronites, sympathetic to the right-wing anti-Palestinian Falangist Party. I was living in Beirut with my wife, Mona, in the years leading up to the Civil War, first working on my doctoral dissertation, and then teaching at the Lebanese University and the American University of Beirut. With a group of friends, Palestinian graduate students, and residents of Tal al-Za'tar, we had opened the first preschool in the camp, backed by Jamiyat in Ash al-Mukhayyam, a Lebanese-Palestinian charitable organization. Relations between the camp and its surroundings became increasingly fraught as the situation in Lebanon deteriorated, and by May 1973, it was clear that Tal al-Za'tar and the nearby Debay and Jisr al-Basha refugee camps, as well as the Palestinian community in the Karantina area, were in decidedly hostile territory. Their neighbors deeply resented the presence of heavily armed Palestinian militiamen in the camps. In these perilous circumstances, we were all concerned about the safety of the small children in the preschool, so we dug a shelter beneath the center. Several other groups, and eventually the PLO, also built shelters, which saved many lives when the war broke out in earnest in 1975. One Sunday in April that year, Muna and I were having lunch in Tal el-Za'atar, at the home of the parents of our friend, Qasim, when we heard that there had been an incident on the road that led to the camp, which ran through the mainly Maronite suburb of Ain al-Rumana. We were advised to leave immediately. Driving back to West Beirut in our old VW Beetle, we spotted a small bus stopped at an awkward angle in the middle of the road. It had just been ambushed on its way back to Tal el-Za'atar by Falangist militiamen who had killed all of its 27 passengers. It transpired that the Falangists had taken revenge for a shooting at a Maronite church nearby where their leader, Pierre Gamayel, had been present. Thus began the 15-year Lebanese civil war. We were never able to return to Tal el-Za'atar, besieged by what came to be called the Lebanese forces, headed by Pierre Gamayel's son, Bashir. The camp was overrun in August 1976, and its entire population was expelled. Perhaps 2,000 people were killed in what was probably the largest single massacre during the entire war. Some died during the siege, some when they fled the camp, and some at LF checkpoints, where Palestinians were picked up and taken away to be murdered. Two of the teachers from our preschool were killed in this way, as was Jihad, Qasim's 11-year-old niece, who was kidnapped and murdered at a roadblock together with her mother. The LF carried out the Tal el-Za'atar massacre with Israel's covert support. Years later, in 1982, facing paramilitary attacks by Labor Party leaders, Ariel Sharon upheld his conduct during the notorious Sabra and Shatila massacres in September of that year, in which over 1,000 civilians were killed, by pointing to the Israeli government's support for the Falangists at the time of the 1976 killings in Tal el-Za'atar. In a secret meeting of the Knesset Defense and Foreign Affairs Committee, Sharon revealed that Israel's military intelligence officers, who were on the spot at the time of the Tal el-Za'atar massacre, reported that the Falangists were killing people with the weapons we supplied and the forces we helped them build. Sharon went on to say to Shimon Peres, leader of the opposition Labor Party, which had been in power in 1976, "You and us are acting according to the same moral principles. The Falangists murdered in Shatila, and the Falangists murdered in Tal el-Za'atar. The link is a moral one. Should we get involved with the Falangists or not? You supported them and continued to do so after Tal el-Za'atar." While Israeli military and intelligence officers may not have been inside the camps, as Sharon pointed out to the Knesset committee, they were present at the command posts from which both operations were directed. According to Hassan Sabri al-Kholi, the horrified Arab League mediator in Lebanon, who was present in the LF operations room and tried to halt the 1976 massacre as it was taking place, Israeli officers and two Syrian liaison personnel, Colonel Ali Madani and Colonel Mohammed Kholi, were there at the time. Few images are more symbolic of the odds faced by the Palestinians during the Lebanon War than that of Israeli and Syrian officers whose coexistence in Lebanon had been brokered by Henry Kissinger to break the back of the PLO. Looking on as LF commanders directed a massacre at a Palestinian refugee camp. But as Kissinger said in another context, covert action should not be confused with missionary work. The war in Lebanon had multiple protagonists, Lebanese and non-Lebanese, each one with different objectives. But for a number of them, the PLO was a major target. To those Lebanese who opposed the PLO, most of them Maronite Christians, their resistance to the armed Palestinian presence was carried out in the name of Lebanese nationalism and independence. As most Palestinian refugees in Lebanon were Sunni Muslims, and because the secular PLO was allied with Lebanese leftist and Muslim groups, the Maronites feared a disruption of the country's sectarian political system, which the French mandate had rigged in their favor in the early 1920s. To Syria, Lebanon was a vital strategic arena it sought to dominate, a potential point of vulnerability in the conflict with Israel, and the site of its struggle with the PLO over leadership of the Arab front against Israel. These became crucial issues for Damascus as Egypt moved inexorably toward a separate peace with Israel and, in effect, became the U.S. client state it has been ever since. While losing its Egyptian ally, Syria needed to find another counterweight to Israel, and domination of Lebanon, the Palestinians, and Jordan may have seemed like the only viable option. The boundless mistrust between the Syrian president Hafez al-Assad and the PLO's Arafat exacerbated the situation, as did the PLO's backing of Lebanese leftist formations, which were thereby enabled to take a position more independent of Damascus. For the Israeli government, indirect and direct involvement in the Lebanon War furnished a welcome opportunity to acquire Lebanese clients, develop a new sphere of influence, and weaken Syria and its allies. Most important, the war provided an opening to retaliate against the PLO's sporadic attacks on Israelis, undermining and perhaps crippling it. This would also neutralize the threat that Palestinian nationalism posed to Israel's permanent control of the occupied territories, where millions more restive Palestinians had come under Israel's rule after 1967. The PLO's attacks launched from Lebanon, which often targeted civilians, gave different Israeli governments all the provocation they needed to justify interventions against their northern neighbor. Israeli methods ranged from direct support in the form of arms and training for the PLO's foes, notably the LF, which received equipment worth $118.5 million and training for 1,300 militiamen, according to an official Israeli source, to the assassinations and car bombings that killed Palestinian leaders and countless civilians. Senior Israeli military and intelligence personnel recounted details of some of these operations in a book in which the chapter on Lebanon is entitled A Pack of Wild Dogs. The reference is to how Israeli operatives described their allies in the LF, which they employed for many of the most gruesome of these lethal operations. The United States supported Israel's goals in Lebanon under Nixon, Ford, and Kissinger, and later under Carter, Vance, and Brzezinski, as well as during the Reagan administration. The two essential objectives of U.S. Middle East policy were to woo the most important Arab state, Egypt, away from the Soviet Union, while not allowing the Middle East conflict to complicate détente with the USSR. This required steering Egypt toward acceptance of Israel. Egypt's complete alignment with the U.S. would let American leaders claim that they had won the Cold War in the Middle East, while establishing a Pax Americana. Given the magnitude and importance to Washington of these strategic objectives, the PLO's opposition was a relatively minor obstacle, and there were plenty of Middle Eastern parties that were happy to help the United States by acting against it. With the explicit approval of the United States, one of these parties, Syria, launched a direct military assault on the PLO in Lebanon in 1976, as the civil war there was already underway. While Washington and Syria were working toward an understanding about this intervention, Kissinger clarified U.S. objectives. "We could let the Syrians move and break the back of the PLO. This was," he said, "a strategic opportunity which we shall miss." In the end, the United States did not let the opportunity slip away, and Syrian troops engaged in pitched battles with Palestinian commandos in Sidon and the Shuf Mountains and elsewhere. This Syrian intervention was only made possible after Kissinger persuaded Israel not to oppose it via a tacit agreement on red lines that set geographical limits to the Syrian advance. The involvement of the United States in hostilities against the Palestinians long preceded its green light to Syria in 1976. Henry Kissinger had no place for the PLO or for the resolution of the Palestinian problem in his Cold War-driven framework for the Middle East. For him, the Palestinians, in league with the Soviets and radical Arab regimes, were at worst a hindrance to be removed, and at best a problem to be ignored. In furtherance of the American Cold War aims and his single-minded pursuit of these goals, Kissinger was instrumental in negotiating three important disengagement agreements between Israel and Egypt and Syria after the 1973 war, which were precursors to a separate Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. To achieve this, Kissinger sought only to contain the Palestine issue, prevent it from interfering with his diplomacy, and render it manageable, if necessary, by the use of force exerted by a range of proxies. This was the case in Jordan from the late 1960s until 1971, and later in Lebanon in the early to mid-1970s, when the PLO opposed Egypt's U.S.-encouraged drift toward a direct settlement with Israel. In both cases, Kissinger colluded with America's local allies to crush the Palestinian movement, standing behind all of them in the shadows, often indirectly responsible, was the United States. Still, Kissinger admitted in his memoirs that the Palestinians' fate was, after all, the origin of the crisis. And as anyone who followed his long career can attest, he was nothing if not a pragmatist. Even as he was negotiating the terms of Syria's military intervention against the Palestinians in 1975, Kissinger also authorized covert, indirect talks with the PLO. These contacts were necessarily clandestine because of a pledge the Secretary of State had made in a secret U.S.-Israel memorandum of agreement in September that year. According to this pledge, the United States promised not to recognize or negotiate with the Palestine Liberation Organization until the PLO recognized Israel's right to exist, abjured from the use of force, coded as terrorism, and accepted SC Resolutions 242 and 338, which passed in 1973, reaffirmed SC 242 and called for negotiations between the parties concerned under appropriate auspices, meaning a multilateral peace conference, later convened at Geneva. Notwithstanding this clandestine promise to Israel, soon after, Kissinger asked President Gerald Ford to approve U.S. contact with the PLO. He argued that there would be no change in our position toward the PLO on the Middle East question, but we have no commitment to Israel not to talk to the PLO exclusively about the situation in Lebanon. Ostensibly, the purpose of these contacts was to ensure the security of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut and of American citizens during the Lebanese Civil War, which the PLO undertook to do. Over several subsequent years, there was extensive coordination between intelligence personnel from the two sides about such security, provided by the PLO. When these dealings became known, Israel's response was harshly critical, but the U.S. government affirmed their limited nature. However, U.S. PLO contacts rapidly expanded well beyond these original limited aims to encompass the general political situation in Lebanon. In 1977, the U.S. ambassador in Beirut, Richard Parker, was tasked with maintaining contacts regarding a variety of political issues through intermediaries affiliated with the PLO, among them a professor at the AUB and a prominent Palestinian businessman. There can be little question that despite Kissinger's justification, U.S. discussions with the PLO violated the terms of the 1975 Memorandum of Agreement with Israel. Once the Israeli government discovered what was going on, it reacted forcefully to this betrayal, as they saw it. In January 1979, Israeli agents in Beirut assassinated Abu Hassan Salama, the key PLO figure involved in these contacts, by bombing his car, causing a huge explosion that resulted in a ball of fire. Salama had been the head of Yasser Arafat's personal security service, Force 17, and Israel claimed that he had been involved in the 1972 attack on Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics. However, an account based on interviews with Israeli intelligence officers involved in the operation states that the Mossad eventually reached the conclusion that cutting this channel was important to give the Americans a hint that this was no way to behave toward friends. The assassination did not end the contacts, although they became even more deeply shrouded in secrecy, as both the United States and the PLO took the heavy-handed Israeli hint. In 1978, John Gunther Dean, Parker's successor as ambassador to Lebanon, was ordered to continue the channels of communication, which broadened to include the first direct interactions between American and PLO officials, and came to address an even wider range of political topics. Among these were the terms for PLO acceptance of SC 242 and for U.S. recognition of the PLO, the inclusion of the PLO in peace negotiations, the Iranian Islamic Revolution, and freeing American hostages being held in Tehran. For at least 4 years, the United States was clandestinely negotiating with the PLO, its pledge to Israel notwithstanding. Dean was the target of an assassination attempt in 1980. The Front for the Liberation of Lebanon from Foreigners claimed responsibility, but this group was later identified in interviews with Israeli intelligence sources as an Israeli-controlled operation. Dean always maintained that Israel was behind the attempt to kill him, and this evidence, in addition to Israel's assassination of several Palestinians involved in contacts with the United States, appears to bear out Dean's claim. Correspondence with the State Department during 1979, to which Dean provided me access, illustrates the extent of these U.S. PLO contacts in ways that are not fully reflected in the official State Department documentary series, Foreign Relations of the United States. They include, for example, extensive exchanges on PLO efforts to free American hostages held in the embassy in Tehran, a number of whom were apparently released at least in part because of Palestinian intercession with the Iranian revolutionary regime. While the contacts began via intermediaries, they led to direct meetings between Dean and, among others, Brigadier Sa'id Sayed, Abu al-Walid, a former Jordanian army officer, the PLO's chief of staff, and its senior military officer. He too was later assassinated, perhaps by Syrian agents, or possibly by those of Israel. As important as the extent and range of the exchanges was their tenor. The Palestinian intermediaries involved talked at length with Dean and one of his colleagues about terms for the PLO's acceptance of SC-242. It was willing to do this with some reservations, and how that could lead to official, open U.S.-Palestinian contacts. Agreement on this matter was never reached. The Palestinians involved repeatedly relayed the PLO's desire for recognition from Washington of its efforts on behalf of U.S. interests, but Dean was authorized only to express his government's gratitude for the provision of security to American institutions. The United States never offered the political recompense for these services that the Palestinian leadership apparently expected. While American contacts were ongoing with the PLO in Beirut, President Jimmy Carter's administration, working to hold a multilateral Middle East peace conference in Geneva, issued a joint communique with the USSR in October 1977. The communique broke ground, referring to participation of all parties to the conflict, including those of the Palestinian people. A statement made by Carter some months earlier, calling for a homeland for the Palestinians, signaled a different tone in Washington. However, under pressure from the newly elected Likud government in Israel, led by Menachem Begin, and from Egypt's Anwar Sadat, the administration soon abandoned its push for a comprehensive settlement and the inclusion of the Palestinians in negotiations. Instead, it adopted the bilateral Camp David process, resulting in the separate Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty of 1979. This process was specifically designed by Begin to freeze out the PLO, allow unimpeded colonization of the occupied territories occupied in 1967, and put the Palestine issue on hold, which is where it remained for over a decade. While Sadat and American officials feebly protested this sidetracking of the Palestinian issue, whose importance Carter had stressed at the outset of his presidency, in the end they acquiesced. For Sadat, the treaty restored the Sinai Peninsula to Egypt. For Begin, the unilateral Egyptian peace strengthened Israel's control of the rest of the occupied territories and permanently removed Egypt from the Arab-Israeli conflict. For the United States, the treaty completed Egypt's shift from the Soviet to the American camp, diffusing the most dangerous aspects of the superpower conflict in the Middle East. Given the vital importance of these national goals to all three parties, Begin was allowed to dictate the terms where Palestine was concerned, at Camp David and in the 1979 peace treaty. All of this was apparent to the PLO leadership, and the later phases of their indirect interaction with the United States government reflected their increasing bitterness. They saw that the PLO's cooperation in Lebanon, far from having been reciprocated, was in fact repaid with further isolation of the organization by the United States and its Israeli ally. Although under Carter the United States had come close to endorsing the Palestinians' national rights and their involvement in negotiations, the two sides found themselves farther apart than ever. Camp David and the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty signaled U.S. alignment with the most extreme expression of Israel's negation of Palestinian rights, an alignment that was consolidated by Ronald Reagan's administration. Begin and his successors in the Likud, Yitzhak Shamir, Ariel Sharon, and then Benjamin Netanyahu, were implacably opposed to Palestinian statehood, sovereignty, or control of the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. Ideological heirs of Ze'ev Jabotinsky, they believed that the entirety of Palestine belonged solely to the Jewish people, and that a Palestinian people with national rights did not exist. At most, autonomy might be possible for the local Arabs, but this autonomy would apply only to people, not to the land. Their explicit aim was to transform the entirety of Palestine into the land of Israel. Via the treaty with Egypt, Begin ensured that nothing would interfere with the implementation of the Likud vision. The foundation he had cannily laid down, which was adopted by the United States, formed the basis of everything that would follow. Future negotiations would be restricted to the terms of self-rule for an infinitely extendable interim period and exclude any discussions of sovereignty, statehood, Jerusalem, the fate of refugees, and jurisdiction over the land, water, and air of Palestine. Meanwhile, Israel set about reinforcing its colonization of the occupied territories. In spite of occasional meek American and Egyptian protestations, the conditions imposed by Begin set the ceiling for what the Palestinians were allowed to negotiate for. In the wake of the 1979 peace treaty, conditions became even worse for the Palestinians. The Lebanon War ground on, destroying much of the country, exhausting its people, and debilitating the PLO. At different stages, the PLO found itself facing the Israeli, Syrian, and Lebanese armies, as well as Lebanese militias supported covertly by an array of states, including Israel, the United States, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. Nevertheless, after all this, and despite an Israeli incursion in 1978, the Litani operation, which left a swath of South Lebanon under the control of its proxy, the South Lebanese Army, the PLO was still standing. Indeed, it remained the strongest force in large parts of Lebanon, those that were not in the hands of foreign armies or their proxies, including West Beirut, Tripoli, Sidon, the Shuf Mountains, and much of the south. It would take one more military campaign to dislodge the PLO, and in 1982, American Secretary of State General Alexander Haig agreed to Ariel Sharon's plan for Israel to finish off the organization, and with it, Palestinian nationalism.